the use of hypnosis to create multiple personalities and in general for intelligence purposes appears in a number of confidential secret documents, just a few of which I'll throw up on the screen. Some stories have leaked out how the CIA hid it. How they hid it, they didn't tell anybody about it. Very simple. The CIA explodes the old theory of hypnotic moral curb. They came to the conclusion that people can be induced to do things that would violate their moral codes, and that the folklore you can't get people to do things against their will was simply untrue. And they carried those experiments further to study ways to create unwitting killers. CIA documents tell of a 1954 project to create involuntary assassins. This is the end product of Morse Allen's work. By 1954, he had exploded the moral curb theory. He had replicated all of the experiments on hypnotic coercion and had conducted other experiments on his own. But all of these were, in fact, laboratory-type experiments. He wanted to do more. He wanted to see whether operational use could be put to these principles. And so his group prepared a film called The Black Art. In the film, a, quote, Oriental character, unquote, is having a drink with an American agent. A drug is surreptitiously placed in the drink that causes the Oriental man to fall asleep. While dozing, he's hypnotized and programmed. The CIA had already experimented on hypnotizing people in sleep conditions and so forth. The next scene shows the Oriental man opening a safe containing secret files. He removes the files and then brings them to an American agent who reinforces the hypnotic suggestion. At this point, there's a voiceover by a narrator who asks, could what you have seen been accomplished without the individual's knowledge? Yes. Against the individual's will? Yes. With complete amnesia of performing the act? Yes. How? Through the powers of suggestion and hypnosis. By 1954, Morse Allen was pushing hard to have operational tests of the thesis that you could construct a multiple personality and have that personality commit crimes, come back, and have no knowledge in the host that that act had been committed. In other words, the Manchurian Candidate scenario had been worked out by the CIA 5 years before the novel was published. But would it work? In order to know whether it worked, you had to conduct what Morse Allen called terminal experiments. These were experiments that could result in the death of the subject. The CIA gave clearance for those experiments to be done, and in reference to one researcher who was asked if he would participate in them, he said, if you'd set up terminal experiments, I'll do them for free. By 1954, literature demonstrates that Morse Allen's concerns had reached the higher levels of the CIA and that they were willing to engage in a field test for the Manchurian Candidate type scenario. A January 1954 artichoke memo says, quote, could an individual of a certain descent be made to perform an act of attempted assassination involuntarily under the influence of artichoke, unquote. And then later in the memo it says, as a trigger mechanism for an even bigger project, the CIA proposed, quote, that an individual of a certain descent, approximately 35 years old, well-educated, proficient in English, and well-established socially and politically in a foreign government, be induced under artichoke to perform an act involuntarily of attempted assassination against a prominent foreign politician or, if necessary, against an American official. Unquote. Now, it was clear then by summer of 1954 that the artichoke team said we can create an artificial personality, program that personality to conduct an assassination. That assassination would occur. If, in fact, the individual was captured, he would never reveal the knowledge that he had engaged in the assassination because the host would know nothing about the altar. The amnesia barrier would be impenetrable, and even under torture, the host would not reveal the secrets. CIA research in many universities around the country, explored topics such as programming people by way of telephone, whether somebody could be answer a telephone, a secret word would be given, they would slip automatically into a trance, nobody around them would know they were in trance, they wouldn't know they were in trance, and so forth. Experiments on pain, experiments on creating unconscious recorders, experiments were done on whether people would commit suicide under hypnotic instructions and so on. Albert Mohl had written 100 years ago that it would be possible to give people hypnotic instructions to have them commit suicide. These were the subjects of CIA experiments. What ultimately happened, we don't know because the government files closed up at the point of reporting on the assassination attempts. But a year later, a May 1955 top-secret report called Hypnotism and Covert Operations begins with the following paragraph. Frankly, I now mistrust much of what is written by academic experts on hypnotism. Partly this is because many of them appear to have generalized from a very few cases, and partly because much of their cautious pessimism is contradicted by agency experimenters. But more particularly because I have personally witnessed behavior responses which respected experts have said are impossible to obtain, unquote. By 1954, the Manchurian candidate scenario had already been thought of and was already under operational testing. This is Richard Condon, who wrote The Manchurian Candidate. As Walter discovered when Walter wrote him, he had no idea that he was writing fact. He thought he was writing fiction. The only case that has come out of the literature that suggests someone who may have been an experimental subject is the control of Candy Jones. Candy was quite a beautiful woman, second only to Betty Grable as a pinup girl during World War II. But her artificial personality, Arlene Grant, was programmed by the CIA, according to the book, to be a hypnotic courier, and she was sent around the world and occasionally captured and tortured. Her last instruction was to have a two-week vacation in Bermuda and then jump off a cliff. It did not happen because her husband, John Neble, who was a very famous all-night disc jockey in New York and an amateur hypnotist, shortly after they were married, began to feel that he had actually married two different women and could not account for the mood swings and the differences in personality using hypnosis with her. This story unraveled. Candy was sent to Herb Spiegel for evaluation. Herb did a workup on her using the hypnotic induction profile and other tests and found she was very, very high hypnotizable. And while he couldn't conclude that what she was saying was true, he could conclude that it would be true of her if it were true. In other words, she is the kind of person that this manipulation would have worked with. And so the Candy Jones story, which we cannot validate and we cannot invalidate, I've seen a CIA file marked Grant, but I've not been able to get its contents. It may be true, it may not be true. But this story about hypnotically programming couriers and assassins clearly is true. And that book was published before the CIA documents were made available. All of this, of course, violates the Nuremberg standards, but those standards have had no application in covert activities. We found a document from the Attorney General of the United States from the Attorney General of the United States to the Director of Central Intelligence, which said that if any of your agents are caught during their work, they will not be prosecuted for crimes. And therefore, there is essentially the 007 license to kill, that CIA agents will not be prosecuted for their crimes. Therefore, the Nuremberg standards do not apply. It wasn't until the Nelson Rockefeller report to the president in June 1975 that we had any inklings about this material. And then basically a paragraph or maybe even just a sentence mentioning mind and behavior control sent researchers looking for the files. In his testimony before Congress, Stansfield Turner corroborated the existence of the mind control programs. Some people wrote about them at the time. Peter Watson's book from England, The Military Uses and Abuses of Psychology, touch on, but do not give in any detail, the experiments done by the CIA and Army, but do talk in general about the use of psychology for military purposes. The classic works, of course, are Walter's book, Operation Mind Control, which is hard to find, and a collector's item, an extremely important book. John Marx's book, The Search for the Manchurian Candidate, and my book, The Mind Manipulators. All three of them, these were the only three books to appear on the subject of mind and behavior control by the CIA and Army experimental programs. I want to move the story forward some more from the CIA experiments in the 1950s into the 1960s and beyond. The 1960s brought us a new variation, and that is the operational utilization of the techniques of brainwashing and sensory deprivation and so forth that had been explored in the 1940s and especially in the 1950s. And this is the religious cult issue. This is Steve Hassan's book, Combating Cult Mind Control. There's a revised edition available for sale, probably the best of the deprogramming books on mind control. But it was in the 1960s that the idea of using these techniques on essentially freestanding populations was experimented with, and the cults provide the laboratory setting for social influence processes where the people are not taken into a complete physical custody. And so the cults themselves represent, I think, the step from the laboratory experiments into the real-world operational use, and then beyond them, you know, books like Mind Bending on Cult Deprogramming. Beyond them, we move into the books on Satanism and on programming. This one, I think, is available for sale there. There are a couple more. This one may also be available for sale. Satan's Children, linking the multiple personality issue with Satanism. Can we prove this? Where do we stand with our knowledge of Satanism? Well, speaking as a lawyer, it's going to be very rough going to prove a widespread intergenerational network of satanic cults in court. Part of the reason for that is the report issued, Pursuit of Satan, by Ken Lanning, who has concluded that though instances of satanic abuse do exist, there is no evidence to support intergenerational, widespread, multinational networks of satanic abuse. Also, within the next 2 months, the most major study in the country on this issue will reach the same conclusions as Ken Lanning, and that report is due in about 2 months. But the tentative conclusion, which will be the final conclusion, is that Lanning's perception is correct and that the evidence does not exist for intergenerational. Now, the methodology can be challenged, and in any event, the question of whether therapists who work with people who claim to be abused in satanic cults should be sued is a separate issue from what can be proven. Is it reasonable for you to believe that widespread satanic abuse occurs? And the answer, I think, to that is yes. Despite the Lanning report and despite the conclusion that will come out later on, it is your job to believe your patients, at least within the therapy setting. And if they say it happened, then you work effectively with them by believing it happened. It's when there's a real-world corollary that the trouble begins. And so, using my lawyer hat now, do not tell your patients to go out and sue their fathers or sue other people. Do not tell them to give newspaper accounts and so on. And to protect yourself in your clinical notes, say that this is the story your patient told. You have no way of knowing whether it's true or not, and in any event, that's not your function. Your function is to make the person whole with whatever material they present to you. As long as you do not advise that they go out and sue other people, you can advise them to seek legal help. If they say, you know, should I sue? You say, that's not my job. I'm not a lawyer. You should go to a lawyer and see what the lawyer says. I will support you in this session, whatever you decide to do. But what you decide to do in the outside world is a decision that must be made by you and other professionals, not by me. As long as you do that, there should be no legal liability. If your patient sues you for believing all the crap that you're being told, in your note somewhere should be, it's not my job to evaluate the historical validity of this information. But I will work with it as if it's true, because for my client at this point in time, it is true. And that should protect you. All right, let's move on. There are isolated instances. There are also a large accumulation of information from local police departments who are not as influential as the FBI. And the FBI did deny the existence of the mafia. When I went to an FBI friend of mine who oversees the behavioral science program there, I said, why does the FBI deny the existence of widespread Satanism and so on? And he looked at me and said they also denied the existence of the mafia. Their conclusions can be rebutted in part by a lot of data from local police that have found ritualistic killings. The book Mortal Remains is an illustration of a case in Massachusetts where the bones were found, where a satanic cult was practicing ritual murder. And so there are instances in which it can be proven. The existence of Satanism is provable for over many centuries. And the existence of cults and mind control programming is provable beyond question. And so for therapists to believe that there are some cults that are satanic is true. To believe that those satanic cults, you know, may be more widespread than we think, when we have thought beforehand, is reasonable. To believe that they engage in a bunch of horrendous practices, look what the Nazi experimenters did and look what Ewan Cameron did. And how can you say there's a limit on human depravity? And so it's not unreasonable to believe that these kinds of things can occur. And in any event, when you work with trauma, you work more effectively by believing the story that it has come from. Okay. Let's go further. In breaking bodies and minds, the role of psychiatric abuse and mental health professionals in creating torture victims and mind control victims is discussed. The complicity between torturers and professionals who help in the torture has been documented. This is the Irving Janis report in 1949 that validated the use of hypnosis as part of the conditioning techniques being used by the Soviets. A Rand report in 1958 again reaches the same conclusions, the involvement of hypnosis in brainwashing and other forms of programming. The book Why Men Confess is one of the, written by a former Assistant Attorney General of the United States, traces modern mind control back to the Malleus Maleficarum through the Moscow show trials and other places. It's a good legitimate source for understanding the modern false memory stuff, which I'll get to right now. There has been only one completely litigated case involving false memory. Can you implant false memories? Of course. We knew that 100 years ago. And we've come a long way since then, as you can see in this talk. This is Eileen Franklin and her daughter. Her case is the only criminal case which has gone to trial in which repressed memory played a major role. She claimed that her father killed her friend Susan Nason, who's up on the top. Look at, and that's her daughter on the bottom. Look how much alike they are. The story that Eileen Franklin tells is that she was looking into her daughter's eyes one day, and suddenly the image of watching her father kill her friend Susan when Susan was 8 years old, 20 years earlier, came into her mind, and then the memory started to flood back of that experience. This is her father when he was arrested. Take a good look at him. Here he is at trial on the right. You learn a lesson about lawyering. That's his lawyer on the left. You clean up the client. You don't bring him into court looking like that. Nope, he looks like that on the right. Now, yeah, you can introduce the pictures, but it's not as powerful as the present appearance. Now, the Franklin case is a very troubling one, and we have to be honest about that because we are first and foremost scientists. And unlike the false memory, we do not need to have a political agenda here. Eileen Franklin is a liar. She told four different stories about the genesis of her memory, one of which was that she was hypnotized in therapy. If that story were true, she would have been disqualified as a witness in California courts. When she learned that, or we hypothesized that when she learned that, she went back to her brother and she said, you know, I told you I'd been hypnotized. Forget I said that. That's tampering with evidence. And so she told actually four different stories about how she recovered her memory, and that's grounds to disbelieve her because there is clear evidence of lying in the way in which she has presented herself. On the other hand, the fact that she's a liar does not mean that the story she told is false. The false memory people make that assumption, and that's bad logic. They may be right that she's a liar and her story is false, but you cannot make that jump as a logical matter. On the other hand, her father is my first knowledge of the case, real knowledge, came from a cab ride with Beth Loftus on my left and David Spiegel on my right in Chicago, when Beth and I were both plenary speakers at the ISSMPD meeting in Chicago a few years back. And both of them had just come from testifying in the case. Both of them testified against Eileen Franklin. Each of them in the cab, in my presence, concluded that if her story were true, and that it might be true, it would have been true of this man. This man abused physically abused his son and sexually molested his daughters. He had a violent past. It's well documented. When he was arrested, he had a large collection of child pornography. He had an active correspondence with women to have sexual relations with their 7 and 8 year old daughters. He had pictures of those activities involving him. Her memories may be true or may not be true. He is the kind of person they would be true of. There was independent physical corroboration, in other words, of his pedophilia, of his violence, and of the fact that this is the kind of man who would have committed that sadistic molesting and murder. It's up to the jury then to decide whether that evidence is enough. But her repressed memory was not the only basis of the testimony. The defense argued that everything that she remembered was available in a newspaper somewhere. She had no independent memories apart from anything that was in a newspaper. And that point was made to the jury. The jury convicted, Franklin is the father is now in jail for life. The California courts have rejected his appeal. And his lawyers have filed a motion in federal district court. They have imported Richard Offshee, a specialist in social influence, to work over the mother who testified against him at trial, and she has now changed her mind. Of course, this is not an unusual phenomenon. Now that he's in jail and she can have recriminations, she might have changed her mind anyway, but the introduction of a social influence specialist with a political agenda to spend a lot of time with her to reach a certain conclusion, it seems to me, is a point, if there is a new trial, that will be raised at that new trial. What I found very interesting is I interviewed the lawyer, his lawyer, the prosecutor, and his appellate lawyers. And in their brief on appeal, the appellate lawyers wrote that no responsible person would believe that the concept of robust repression is false. In other words, the Offshe-Singer hypothesis that you cannot forget traumatic events over a sustained period of time, and that it's the, quote, scientific quackery of the 20th century, unquote, is, in the opinion of these lawyers, irresponsible thinking. And I agree. The evidence shows that the Offshe-Singer hypothesis is wrong. The evidence comes from biological studies of memory and how the brain processes traumatic memories differently than normal memories. And that also explains why Loftus's research on normal memory is irrelevant to the issue of traumatic memory, a point that she is now reluctantly starting to recognize. Is Eileen Franklin at trial? Is Freud dead? If you knock out the notion of robust repression, as the false memory people have been trying to do, you have a very simplistic idea. If a person can be repeatedly traumatized as a child, have no adult recollection of that trauma, go into therapy and then have a recollection, then the therapist must have implanted it if robust repression is not real. And so the existence of robust repression as the underpinning of the scientific foundation for the false memory argument is quite crucial. But that argument is now shown to be scientifically invalid, which doesn't mean that the false memory position is wrong. They are right about what therapists have been doing and shouldn't be doing, the misuse of social influence procedures. But they're wrong about the issue of robust repression. That means that somebody can go to a therapist and have that memory refreshed, and that memory can be true, which makes it a harder case. The world is no longer black and white. You cannot use the iatrogenic cause argument in every case of robust repression. The Father Porter cases are an illustration of robust repression, memories that were recovered without hypnotic intervention and in the absence of a therapeutic encounter. You may know the Father Porter story. My time is short, so I can't go through it with you now. But in any event, he recovered the memories of having been molested. He was able to validate those memories as to himself. And Father Porter is now in jail having confessed to having molested between 50 and 100 young boys and girls. And so in the search for the unraveling of the human mind, mind control is real. It has a rich history. I've only given you a fraction of the history. We haven't touched, as I said, on the physiological or pharmacological aspects. We haven't talked about behavior modification and conditioning techniques and so forth. We've just concentrated on the principles that are closest to the work that you'll be doing. We haven't talked about social influence theories in general. But the existence of mind control, its work in secret laboratories, its work in CIA and Army experiments, its spilling over into religious cult settings, and its use in freestanding populations are all validated. And that ought to give hypnosis the kind, give mind control the kind of respectability it deserves, and give you the background to believe the kinds of stories that your patients are telling you as at least possible. Thank you.
We've been listening to a lecture by Dr. Alan Shefflin entitled The History of Mind Control, What We Can Prove and What We Can't. You've been listening to CKLN 88.1 in this series on mind control. Next week we're going to be having featuring an interview with Claudia Mullen, Valerie Wolf, and Chris Ebner the day that they had given the mind control testimony to the Presidential's Advisory Committee on Human Radiation Experiments in 1995. If you have missed any of the shows, just stay tuned for this message and find out how you can remedy that.
CKLN is rebroadcasting a groundbreaking radio series, Mind Control in Canada, currently airing on the Sunday morning show, The International Connection. Starting June 2nd on alternative radio, Monday nights from 10 to 11 p.m., the 8-month radio series Mind Control in Canada will be aired. This series looks into the U.S. and Canadian government's history of mind control experimentation and particularly the experiments done to children in creating programmed multiple personalities by means of severe trauma and abuse. If allegations of the survivors are true, and what government documentation would point to, the leaders, intelligence agencies, and militaries of North America have been using mind control for political, military, and criminal purposes for decades. To hear interviews and lectures with survivors, researchers, and therapists on this important topic, tune in to CKLN 88.1 FM Monday evenings from 10 to 11 p.m. for the rebroadcasts, or Sunday mornings 9:30 to 10:30 a.m. for the breaking story on mind control.